Good morning, neighbor. I'm glad we're together again. We have a very special show for you today on Mr. Jones's Neighborhood, the Children's Program for Reluctant Adults. I'm the host of Mr. Jones's Neighborhood, Ken Jones, no relation, by the way. Mr. Jones's home city of Portland has one of the most talented and supportive literary communities in the country. It's a little like Paris in the 20s, only with food carts, craft beer, and legal cannabis. On today's show, we welcome four shining lights of that community, all writers whose most recent books are collections of short stories. Our guests are Margaret Malone, author of People Like You, which was a Penn Hemingway finalist, Karen Russell, author of Orange World and recipient of both the MacArthur and Guggenheim Fellowship, Kimberly King Parsons, whose book Black Light was longlisted for a 2019 National Book Award, and Lydia Yuknovich, author of the new story collection Verge, which goes on sale February 4th. Lydia's previous books have garnered numerous awards and honors, and my KABU colleague David Naiman calls her Portland's literary fairy godmother. Margaret, Karen, Kim, and Lydia, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having us.
Now, I'm looking around the table and having an almost out-of-body experience. I can't believe you're all here. It's such an incredible group of immense talent, intelligence, and heart. So just very grateful for that. While I'm happy just to sit here and stare and pinch myself, I don't think it's going to work well on radio. So since for all of you, your most recent book is a story collection, I'd like to make this somewhat of a master class in short fiction. I don't think all four of you have been together like this, but you've been paired up in several events. Margaret, when People Like You came out, Lydia blurbed the book. She called it the biggest mouth-to-mouth resuscitation of storytelling I've seen in years. And she also hosted you at your Powell's book launch. And thanks to YouTube, I heard you read the story, Yes, from the book.
Oh, yeah.
But the conversation, unfortunately, wasn't recorded. So I was wondering, it was a few years ago, but do you remember anything that particularly sticks out about your conversation with Lydia then?
You know, the thing that still stuck with me is Lydia was the first person to ask me about class in the stories, which is something that I think had been a subtext of all the stories, of everything I probably have ever written and never knew. It was even subtextual to me in a way. And Lydia was the first person that asked about that. And as soon as she did, it became this like more conscious beacon for me in a really wonderful way.
Has that influenced your current work then, just being a little more conscious of class? And I've seen that too in People Like You.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I don't know that I have enough distance from the next collection yet to know how much, how more obvious it is now. But I just know that I was aware of it in a different way in the writing of it. I don't know that I have distance yet enough to know on the other side of it.
Yeah. And Kim, you and Karen appeared together in your home state a few months ago, and that was for a talk at the Texas Book Festival. It was called Sojourns in the Shadows, Short Fiction That Isn't Afraid of the Dark, which I think applies to every writer in this room. And you've been compared to Karen in several of the reviews of Black Light. Here's one from the LA Times. I don't know if you've read this, Karen. Parsons is an exhilarating, enchanting, charming, an irresistible new voice. Imagine the punk rock stylings of the criminally underappreciated Jeff Parker and the full-throated roar of weird Karen Russell. And then the review goes on to mention a few others. Very good company. But I was wondering if Karen's work was an influence on Black Light. And what do you think you share? Is it that full-throated roar of weirdness?
100% Karen's work is influential to my work. And we were at Columbia. I was a year behind you, and I sort of saw her, the back of her. She was like rushing through. I could see her work, and I was following her since then. But for me, the thing that I've taken from Karen's work is humor, probably most of all. Just having narrators who are able and happy to point out when things are ridiculous, or just to be light in that way, to sort of undercut those sort of more transcendent moments with like the next beat can be funny, like that's okay to do. That was definitely something I took from you from all those times ago.
Yeah, it's a really wild thing. I mean, I read Kim's work for the first time this year, but it's funny, I think this happens that, you know, we think of like influences, it can sound so kind of linear and vertical in time, but I think like in writing world, it's sort of like butterfly generations. It's happening at such a velocity, and it's happening laterally, and that applies to everybody in this room. That, you know, and in Kim's work now, I just felt like there were memories being returned to my body. I've been living in Texas, teaching, and but you know, don't have a lot of terrestrial experience there. And this the landscape and this the human the human landscape too, and everything about Kim's sibling stories, and particular just the slow stickiness of child time, and the weirdness of that threshold where you're watching people metamorphose. You know, you're watching your older siblings, you know, becoming something else before your eyes. Everything that's deeply uncanny about that, about family, I just like really connected to. And I'm so glad that review compared his favorite man wasn't like at her worst. Kim Parsons.
The weird Karen at her, Russell.
Oh, just one quick aside. There's Kim, well, you were born in Lubbock, Texas. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the Buddy Holly story, and Lydia, you actually mentioned that in one of your stories. I read that.
Yeah, I saw that. Well, first I have to try not to crumple, because I'm as thrilled as you are to be at this table with these women. I have so much awe for all of your talent and brilliance and beauty. Sorry, had to get that out. I went to college at Texas Tech, and I have climbed the Buddy Holly statue
in a
drunken stupor.
Amazing. I love that.
It's not that tall, is it?
No, it's pretty short, but I felt like it was incredibly high, and I had accomplished a great feat. But your stories really resonate with me, both of you. My mother was born in Texas, and I went to college there. My first husband was from Texas, and I know your work isn't all about Texas or anything, but there are little moments where all the writers I love, we have these strange nexuses or crisscrossing places that make me vibrate. I love it.
Now, I wanted to get to something, Karen, when we did a previous interview for Orange World. It was a few months ago. You were about 6 months pregnant at the time. I found this quote from you, and this will get into the short story part of the show, which hopefully take us through the rest of the hour. Stories feel special to me because each can become a kind of universe in miniature. As a kid, I loved snow globes and museum dioramas, maybe for the same reason. I also think stories can haunt you in a very particular way. Their velocity and their compactness. I always have the sense, too, with my favorite stories, that the world of the story is still spinning somewhere long after I finish the last page. Because of a story's brevity, you could almost hold it in the palm of your hand. You can walk around its periphery. It stays with you in a different way, I think, than a novel. A story can work on you almost like a poem. You read it in one sustained burst, and it has a different kind of integrity inside you. And Margaret, I wanted to add one quote that I found from you in there, too. Short stories are my primary form and favorite form to work in because they're the closest in shape and freedom of language and brevity, that word again, to how I see the world and prefer to live in it. So this is for everybody at the table. Could you all talk about what attracts you to the short story form?
I think for me, it's something about intensity of voice. And not that you can't have that in a longer piece, but generally with a short story, you're getting in quick. You're getting the reader to where they need to be right away. And so there's this sort of compression that's happening at the sentence level, but also the scenes are compressed. There's, you know, the tendency in a novel, I'm working on a novel now, and it's just, how do we extend and prolong and unpack? And I have the opposite instinct in short stories, which is, how do we get in and cut straight to the bone quick, as fast as possible? So that's what I like about them, is that sort of intensity and how you can sit down, and I have the same feeling that Karen said in the quote that you read, about this feeling that you're sort of looking in on a world that's complete without you, and then it's going to go on after you've left. Whereas there's something about a novel that feels like you're really getting the whole scope of it, but with a short story, it's like just this perfect little piece.
Yeah, I love that too, just that keyhole feeling. And have, my favorite stories have that sense where there's something cruel about stories sometimes. I think they're not everybody's bag. I definitely have friends and relatives who are like, finish the goddamn story. You know what I mean? Because you're sometimes leaving people on a real emotional plateau, or, you know, I feel like in some of Kim's stories, it's like this painful music is gonged inside your body, and then now it's over to you, you know, to live in those reverberations. And I heard Mary Gateskill in a Q&A once, I guess she said, you know, people were sort of upset. They were like, well, we want resolution. We want to know basically how to feel about what you've presented us with. And she was like, well, if you can't be responsible for your feelings, you won't be responsible for your actions. You know, basically, not to paraphrase Mary Gateskill badly. Mm-hmm. But I just sort of, there is something, the demand of a story can be high, I think, for readers, because sometimes it is just that mystery of a personality or the mystery of a moment. Or I love what, in the other quote, just this idea that the day in shards, and you're going to examine this one shard and have the opportunity to really slow down and see it from all angles in a way that's rarely possible in sort of the onrush of life. And in a novel sometimes too, I think the onrush of plot, sometimes you kind of get swept forward. There's this real momentum, which is so pleasurable, but maybe less permission to go clause to clause and beat to beat and really examine something.
I love that idea of the ruthlessness of a story, because when Ken, you first asked that question, I had this very concise visual image of, I have these two kids that are 6 and 8, and they are at this brief age where they play together, and play is a word, I don't know how to use it in any other way, because I don't know, I wouldn't call it playing, but basically they'll just like drag each other down the hallway screaming, and like sometimes they'll think it's fun, and sometimes
like
they won't.
Yeah.
And
I feel like rock.
Exactly. Yeah, but for me, like,
at each other.
That's what a short story is. It's like you get to drag the reader down the hallway, and like sometimes they love it, and it's a really good time, and sometimes they're like, I want this to stop. But whatever that is, like maybe it's the control freak in me. Like that aspect of story writing is the best.
Now, Lydia, in Verge, in one of the stories I can't get out of my head is The Organ Runner, about an abandoned 8-year-old girl in an unnamed Eastern European country. And, oh, man, it's just a terrible existence. She becomes part of a ring of human organ harvesters, kind of like an Oliver Twist, but with no hint of a sentimentality or salvation in that story. It's only about 17 pages, but back to Karen's quote, you create a universe in miniature. In just those 17 pages, and the story haunts the reader, haunted me at least, in that very particular way, Karen, that you mentioned. What are some of the ways you achieve that in a short story, which might not work well in a novel? And you've written both, short fiction and novels.
Well, I was listening intently to the novel part. I'm still trying to figure out how to write novels, so I took some notes while Karen was talking.
You've done a pretty good job in the past.
But I'm working on it. I'm always working. Like, what is it? What is a novel is still a question for me. But in relation to your question, I think of short stories slightly differently in that I think they're like parallel universes, only we don't know very much about them yet. And so when you say they're different worlds or like microcosms of something, to me they are. Like you went through a little portal, mm-hmm. and you get to live in this parallel universe for a very short amount of time. And then when I was listening, it's fascinating to me because though I came out of the tradition and inherited the same forms as everybody else at the table, I think I've spent the last 20 years trying to undo what I learned. And so I write in literary fragments, period. And sometimes those fragments find a place to resolve or a place to hold a tension open, and those are short stories. And sometimes those fragments go on in my work, and they turn into novels. And I'm not abandoning plot as we've inherited it traditionally, but I'm scratching at it and seeing if there's another way to define plot mm-hmm. by and through an emotional intensity or a short set of links. And so, as usual, I just see it slightly differently, but it's related to everyone else, I mean, I promise. But I experience it sitting there maybe a little differently.
Well, why don't we talk about that, the novel versus the short story? Karen, you actually took a short story, and this was Ava Wrestles the Alligator. In your first collection, St. Lucy's Home for Girls Raised by Wolves. And you expanded that into your novel, Swamplandia. What were the reasons for that? I think I asked you when we talked before, what if you took The Gondoliers, a story in here which, Lydia, I think you'd love if you haven't read it already. Okay.
I love all of them.
About two girls kind of almost mutating to adapt to this post-apocalyptic world, this flooded water world. What made you adapt this short story into Swamplandia? Was it the characters? You didn't feel you got the story out in that short piece?
Just quickly to bow before Lydia, because I thought the Book of Joan, I just adore this novel, and it's, I'm sure that was percolating for me when I was imagining this.
I feel completely related to you world. In a very strange way.
Yeah, that's it. We'll have to do some. I don't know, astral travel, figure it out. But I really, it is so funny. I feel like that is another funny way that lineage works. That you start to meet people who they've either you have similar reading histories, or you have like the same like literary godparents or something, and you get to meet them when you read their work. I don't know. I cannot recommend, this will be my PSA for our summit. I can't recommend taking a short story and then making it into a novel. Only a fool would think that that was the way to go. As I learned, I mean, I'm happy that it exists now, but I think my great delusion was, hey, I know, I loved those characters, and I just kept, it was sort of like the literary fragment. It didn't necessarily have a plot that was driving it, but it just kept growing like kudzu. So I had this like kudzu sprawl, which I believed would just sort of on its own become a novel, the way that like moss grows in Portland or whatever. Yeah. You know, I was like, oh, it's happening. And I bet in one summer's time, this will have, you know, I think I had like a very diluted idea about what a novel was. And I still don't know. I still don't know what a novel is. It makes much less sense to me, I think, than a story, where there you sort of feel like here's something that's bounded and I can ricochet and play within this corral. I've corralled something, I've cordoned off some space, and I'm going to explore it. Whereas with a novel, nothing feels cordoned off to me, and it seems like you could just like wander in the snow and die there and never reach a resting place. So that's it's a scarier endeavor for me. And that is how that book felt, and I'm happy to have made it out of the swamp, but I did spend most of my 20s in like an imaginary swamp of the mind. But I loved those characters was the answer, Ken. I think they did continue to haunt me in a way that I felt I owed those sisters and, you know, and their brother kind of a chaperone through that kind of emotional, literal swamp.
Now, Kim, you mentioned you're working on a novel now, and famously it's about motherhood, Texas, and LSD.
the big three.
So, what really surprised me when we talked for Between the Covers, generally, I think when somebody writes a story, they go in and then they cut. Mm-hmm. And you're the opposite. You said you kind of start bare bones and then you just add and add. And that's how you approach a story. How are you approaching the novel?
I mean, it's not that different, actually. It's still, as Lydia was saying about everything that she writes is fragments, I feel like the way that I write is just the way that I write, which is sentence to sentence. So there's always this, you know, I'm putting limitations on myself with every turn, because if I don't feel that cordoned off feeling, then I'll freak out and be like, what am I doing? So I just have to be like, okay, it has to only take place in these two places. It has to only be these three characters. It has to only be like every discovery is a limitation or an obstruction, which to me is really helpful to say, this is it. It can't, no, we can't have this friend character because we're already done with characters, not whatever. Because otherwise I feel like I would just go crazy. There's too much on the menu. Yeah. No new friends, no backstory, no memories.
So how do you resolve that in a novel where you could pretty much go anywhere and add as many characters as you like?
It's all just a trick, right? It's all just a way of tricking myself into doing the work and setting up some sort of a to-do list that I can check off, like a comfortable to-do list for me, which to me looks like sinking really deep into one voice. And so that's it for me. So I, as much as, you know, people, obviously there's so many ways to do a novel and so many beautiful novels that are polyphonic and have 1,000 narrators. And I just really want this one voice, and I had to wait to hear it. And now that I've heard it, I can sink into that. And that's it. But then I try not to outline, or which again, I don't necessarily know I recommend this for other people, but I sort of like to be as in the dark for as long as possible. I know there's a sort of shape sitting at the center of the story, but that's it. And I'm just working every day totally clueless for years and years.
Now, you said that the stories, you start the story when you've got your first line and often the last line.
Yeah.
And not in between. Has that been true with the novel too?
I do have an idea of where things end up, if that makes any sense. And at this point, it doesn't at all make any sense. There's no tendril connecting it yet, but that's the daily part. Let's hope. So, yeah.
And Margaret, people like you, there's actually three stories that have the same main characters, Bert and Cheryl. Yeah. Was that something you considered turning into a novel? You had, you know, very strong characters. You had a situation for them where they were trying to get pregnant, and then Cheryl had a miscarriage. In a previous interview, and I don't know if you stopped, but you said you were working on a novel. And that interview, I think, was a few years ago. So,
yeah.
Is that still the case?
So, to answer the first question, I never thought of turning them into a novel. I thought of doing a whole book of short stories about them. And maybe someday, years from now, I will do that, But yeah, I couldn't write a whole novel just like they need breathers in between them. They're a tough crew, to be around for hundreds of pages, in a wonderful way because they're very real, I think, in the not a good way. For life, if you're living in life. So,
they're also very likable.
They're likable, yeah. But I feel like sometimes they're so unlikably normal that, like, sometimes people read to get away from themselves, and some people read to read about people like themselves. And so, I don't know. That's rambling, but I think it would be, I could not write a novel about them. I hope someday to actually have, like, an entire collection that is just them. Mm-hmm. But it will probably take my whole life to get that.
And
out.
It would be written in short stories.
It would all be short stories. They couldn't. They couldn't have a novel. Huh. I'd drive them off a cliff. I did write a novel after People Like You came out. I wrote a first draft of a novel, and I decided to take everything in terms of the way I wrote, like whatever strategy I had for how I wrote normally for the 15 years before that, I threw it out the window and decided to do everything different to see what would happen and do a novel. And so I wrote the first draft of a novel in about 4 or 5 months, and I think it was really bad. So
are you going to continue to work on it?
It's sitting in a drawer. I need to not look at it for a really long time, I think. And I have other ideas now for other novels that I probably will write once this next collection is, I'm like days away from that being done. So when that's done, awesome. I'll probably set forth again. But
oh, congratulations. Yeah. I didn't know about that.
Thanks. Amazing. Yeah, no, like in days. Yeah.
It's like the very slender bed, right? It's, I just feel like it's sort of like you get to draw a breath before the waves claim you again.
Totally.
Yeah. Yes. Now, I want to get into how you guys actually start stories. And you get the voice right. You get that first sentence, Kim, and often the last sentence. And there's other ways. There's characters, maybe Bert and Cheryl. They're setting Karen with you, Florida, and now the most recent ones, Southeast Portland, which is the title story in Orange World. There's also narrative. Now, Lydia, you said in a previous interview that you actually hear voices.
Damn it.
No. It's not the first writer. Renee Denfeld told me the same thing. Yeah. And she actually got every single novel she's written from voices. She not only hears the voices, she sees the characters. Her first novel was The Enchanted. And she was leaving a prison that she was visiting, because that's her day job, as an investigator. And she actually saw this man, kind of a scraggly man, sitting right next to her with his bare feet up. She described it in detail, though I begged her not to. It was up on the dashboard. And she got the whole impetus of the novel from that. And you've done the same, because in that same interview, you said that's how you got Dora. You got Joan of Arc, which became the Book of Joan, and you're also working on a Mary Shelley novel, and she appeared to you too.
Sorry. Renee and I have talked about that. We do have that in common. I have a sort of slightly different origin story in that I was prescribed lithium as a child for auditory hallucination stuff, which they used to do back then, which is hideous, by the way. So I had a condition that was my first experience of this phrase, hearing voices.
That was not pleasant. Renee's fine with it. I guess she welcomes it, I think.
But where I'm going with it is, as I matured and got help and took care of myself and became an adult, I've come back to the real space and place of hearing voices or seeing things and seeing people, and discovered that artists occupy that space all the time, and there's a place for it, which is the page or the canvas or the musical score or the play. And that's it's a place that's not pathologized by sickness or health. And so when Renee and I have talked about it, it's a joyous thing that we can hear voices or see characters. And so you see what I'm saying? It moved in my life from an extreme trauma and difficulty into the bliss of my life is that I can make art. And I don't feel sick. I feel thrilled to be able to make art. So there's that sad little story. And then the other thing I would add is that I'd throw on the table with everybody else, these other brilliant women writers, that I also watch for the material conditions inhabited by characters or people. Mm-hmm. And I pay really close attention to those conditions. And so setting for me is puny and stupid. I abandoned setting a long time ago. But material conditions, how can I keep a story embedded within the real conditions of that character's life and not try to transcend it or escape it and make it part of who they are? I would add that to, you know, how do you come up with ideas?
That, and that's very evident, I think, in The Organ Runner, the story we mentioned
with
Anastasia.
Her conditions are her body.
Yes,
exactly. You've understood me perfectly. Yes. Thank you. I can go now, right?
Well, I just feel privileged to get to read it before it actually goes on sale. It was just a wonderful book. It's funny because I told you that in Facebook Messenger, and you came back with, sorry, it's a buzzkill.
There's a cheery book.
There's not a lot of comfort and very probably no humor in it, really, which is unusual
for you. I think
there's
some humor, but it's pretty dark humor.
Yeah, pretty dark, because you have a great sense of humor in other work and also you know, personal life.
Well, I think the story with Jesus in it is hilarious, but I'm not certain other people are going to think that about that story. And that's all I'm saying about that story.
Well, I didn't find it a buzzkill, though.
I think I just told
you that to me it's art. You took a buzzkill to me is what's going on in the White House now, and
correct. That's obscene.
Yeah, assassinations and some of the cover-ups by the Republicans.
Correct.
I could get into a rant and I won't. But that to me is a buzzkill. That's not art.
Gotcha.
So you took that situation we're all living in and kind of distilled it in these stories.
Thank you.
I want to also talk about point of view. And Kim, you mentioned a preference for first-person present tense. And you said, I like first-person because it puts you in the head right away. You said, I studied with Gordon Lish for many years, and most of the writing he held up as exemplary was in first-person. And Margaret, you have almost the same preference. I think in people like you, every story is pretty much in first-person present tense. There's one second-person mm-hmm. present tense, and I think there's just two that's first-person past tense. Mm-hmm. And you didn't study under Gordon Lish, but you studied under another master teacher, Tom Spanbauer.
Who studied with Gordon.
So, yes. it's that
not
influence.
That only Gordon Lish. Gordon Lish does not own first-person present tense by any means, but I think I can trace it to that, but it's really just what I like. It's just I've always... when I start to look at all the stories that have things I like in common, it's that. Or it would be nonfiction, like Chronology of Water, reading something in first person because it's a first person story and feeling like I'm in the body with that person. And so it's a good, fast way to get there. But also, you know, obviously there's advantages and disadvantages to all the perspectives, but I do have a preference for that. It seems to be the things that I gravitate towards most are first person present tense.
Yeah, and I'm similar. What I prefer to read is often in first person present tense. And I think for reasons that are kind of similar to the dragging down the hallway image that I had in my head before, which is just, and partly it's a cheat. It's like a really fast way to get people on board. If you can embed really quickly with someone, one individual person, it's less work down the line. You just have to do it well. It's not as effective.
Okay, I actually have a quote from you that it's easier to pull the reader in and drag them into what you want to drag them into in first person present tense. I feel like I have you. I really have someone by the hand.
I'm so violent. I had no idea. This is like this, yeah.
At least you didn't say by the hair.
I'm learning about myself.
That'd be a little more painful.
For it. Absolutely for it.
And Lydia, you didn't study directly with Tom. You weren't part of the Dangerous Writers. But
no,
you
we are writerly friends. His partner has done all the ink on my body. He's the
I've seen the mermaid tattoo.
Yeah.
Yes.
He's the only man I would let write on my body.
It's extremely well done. Very
and his
artistic.
Work has been deeply impactful on my work, but I was never a student of his.
Well, your writing group, there were several people there who studied directly under him. Chuck
Correct.
Palahniuk, Susie Vitello, Monica Drake.
Yep.
So how would you describe Tom's influence on your work? And you use both varying points of view.
Yeah, I can't hold on to a first person
right.
to save my life. Not even
Karen's
my own
the same
memoirs.
Way.
So it isn't so much that attracts me personally, but the lyricism inside Tom's work, which is not always the thing people zoom in on as the, you know, Tom's strength, but the people I love the most do. Margaret has spoken to me about it. His lyricism of language and the way he can suspend a single image for many pages in a novel so that the image knows more than the story or the characters do, and it gets in the body of a reader. I feel like I learned that directly from him. So when I'm going on and on about a girl in the snow watching a foot chew its foot off in a trap, I got that from Tom. Like letting the image linger beyond where the story or plot says it should go, and then it just gets so big in that Flannery O'Connor, you know, objective correlative way that it carries half the story for you. That's pure Tom. I learned that from Tom. The Man Who Fell in Love with the Moon breaks my heart. If I move toward it to pick it up, I start crying. It just undid me forever. And me being me, I eventually made my way to him, the person, so I could just sit and talk with him. So I just have a friendship with him and a love affair with his writing.
And Lydia, I was in your workshop at Menaw Valley, and you brought some of that same. One of the things I thought was so brilliant about that workshop was how one of the first questions you asked about any story was just, everybody take a second and write down the images that stuck with you about this story. And it's so great because we all had, like 90% of us had the same ones, right? And
that means something.
That means something, and that lets the writer know what's working. And it was so, obviously it's this thing that's simple, it's there, but you're like, I had never thought of it that way. It had never occurred to me to just break it down and say, are there three images in this story? And most of the time there are three or less, you know?
That's
and
right.
To just distill it down to that, to the essence, and then to look and see, okay, so how is that working and how is it not? It was so revelatory to me as a student of yours. Thank you.
That's really kind of you to say. I think the other place I just pillaged it from was poetry.
Right.
Because poetry works vertically with a stacked series of images. And in that way, it's a little more like film, you know, spliced images with powerful intensities. And prose writers aren't, the craft discussions don't often go that direction to lyricism and image with the same weight
right.
as plot, character arc, yield. prose writer craft thingies, and it's to our detriment because the stories of today, I was talking to my friend Therese Myatt, who you all know her work. She wrote Heartberries and broke all our hearts. She's a brilliant Native American writer. And we were talking about how little prose you need to grab a reader by the heart in prose writing. And her book, Heartberries, is a great example of that. So I think we could all study on that. And Tom's like had it from the start.
It's funny to me because she and Tom are actually really similar in terms of their open vulnerability.
Agree.
They both are just like, they just like rip their skin off.
It's true. Like here's
here
my
am.
Heart. And it's like, boom, on the table.
Yeah. And that, yes.
That's a big part
of different
his
version of embedding to me is that vulnerability.
Agreed. And that vulnerability is a big part of his dangerous writers.
That's what it's all about. Huh. Yep.
You're listening to Mr. Jones's Neighborhood on KBOO Community Radio. Our in-studio guests this morning are Portland-based masters of the short story, Margaret Malone, Karen Russell, Kimberly King Parsons, and Lydia Yuknovich. Yeah. Now, I kind of got stuck when you mentioned lyricism, because I have a question here about musicality, and I asked Kim about this when we did the Between the Covers interview. The first line of one of her stories, Fiddlebacks, "This house is a house where you shake out your shoes." And Lydia, the last story in Verge, Two Girls, it's almost like a song rather than prose, more a song even than a poem. And it's one very long sentence that goes over two pages. Here's the start. "They are 16 and swinging hands, and the hands hold the wrists of 16 and swinging around and around and dancing their feet in the sand in circles." It's almost like a Buddy Holly, too. Speaking about love. But what Kim was saying is that she often hears the rhythm in her head, and then she fits the words to the rhythm. And you came up with a Paul McCartney analogy.
Scrambled eggs.
Yes, he had yesterday, and he didn't know what was yesterday yet, but he had the melody. And scrambled eggs was three syllables, so that was kind of his temporary title.
Yeah, I think if you think about the image being something that prose writers are often neglecting, I think the reason that I was so drawn to the sort of Lisch school or the Spanbauer school is this idea of sentence level stuff too, which mm-hmm. is about syntax and rhythm and the friction between words and the way that the words sound in your mouth or feel in your mouth or feel in your body when you read them aloud. And so a lot of times I'll get a line in my head totally off the page. I'm not sitting writing. It'll just be something that's in my head when I'm in the shower. And it's not so much like a person talking to me in character, but it's just a fully formed line mm-hmm. that I can't shake in a good way. And I wouldn't want to shake it because it's trying to get my attention for some reason.
Yeah, I've just, oh my goodness, I should have brought my notebook. And I also, I'm the one who's not inducted into Tom Spanbauer's cult, so I need to clearly go out and read everything he's written. But I just love that. Yeah, I've been reading a lot with my little boy, and the way, you know, so many of those books are totally sonic, and yep. you see what a pleasure it is.
Oh, those are the children's books.
Yeah, children's
yes,
books.
Yes, Good Night Moon.
And it's reminding me about just the orality, like the storyteller's pleasure, and that for me as an adult, that's still the pleasure, yeah. you know? In stories, you really have permission to slow down and sort of like watch one word's friction with another word. And there's a lot of half rhyme there. You know, there's like a different mm-hmm. kind of sonic joy. And I think speaking of the integrity of a story, so much of that is because you have acoustically coupled these ideas and the sound is working with the meaning in a mm-hmm. mysterious and, you know, amazing way.
Do you read your work out? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I do, like a crazy person. I don't know. At a certain stage. If I've gotten to that stage, thank Christ. Because that means, you know, it's time. It's like an honor that you bestow upon the language. I'm like, now I will speak you. Like, you're no longer just like reams of gibberish. Now you're approaching.
But
we're
you're
on
doing
the tarmac
that.
To another mind. Story. Let's test it out. It's like the sound check.
But the testing out is to get that musicality, right?
Yeah.
To make sure that it reads like.
Yeah.
Like you want it to. And
absolutely.
Yeah, it almost works on a subconscious level, I think, as a reader, on me, if the rhythm's just right.
Right.
I've
you
even
are
done that with,
rhythm,
with talking. When I listen to myself, say, on the radio, there's a certain rhythm, and
right.
the rhythm's either right or it's wrong to me. And
yeah.
it's weird because, I mean, it's just words, it's prose in a way, but. There should be a musicality to it.
Oh, yeah. Everybody at the tables work just particularly last lines. I don't know if you guys find this, but the power of the last line is almost entirely acoustic. Right? Or you really need to find the right note to strike. It really does feel as close as I'll ever know. You know, I can play a song on the piano. I don't know. I wish that I could read music, but it's like I feel like it's as close as I'll ever come to understanding what choices a musician makes is... kind of trying to maneuver those last lines.
Oh, so many great last lines in all the books. Kim, I think we talked, you had a Amy Hempel quote. Her advice was, you want a short story to punch you in the heart at the end.
Yeah, the last line should punch
yeah.
you in the heart. That, yeah,
and,
which I love.
Not all of the stories, because I mean, it's not always appropriate, but
right.
I could point out the stories in each of these four books where it does that. It's a gut punch.
Yeah, I think it's just that feeling that this is it's the landing for a gymnast or whatever. It's that last moment. And sometimes the story can be better served by being really quiet or by not having a huge punch in the heart. Sometimes that's the right choice, but it's just sort of feeling out what's the best move here. Because it is the last, especially with all of these angry people who read short stories in a hate read them in a fury. And then they're like, it's over now. But that last line isn't, you know, they're ready to hate it by the last line, or they're sad because they see the story's ending. And so you want to leave them with something, you know, that feels right.
And I forgot if one of you had said it, Lydia, maybe it was you, about the last scene in a movie determines if you want to see that movie again, the very last shot.
I didn't know. I don't know if I saw that, but I like it.
Oh, okay.
I don't think I said that, but
it's
like
all
it.
Jumbling in my head now because I've been reading a lot of your past interviews, and that came up in one. Well, you both are married to filmmakers, Margaret and Lydia.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought it was one. Was it you?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. We'll all claim it. We all said it.
Okay. But I was thinking of the movies that I like to see again. And yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Some of them are a little bit ambiguous. And you've mentioned the last story in People Like You.
Mm-hmm.
You've had people come up to you and say, you know, why'd you end it so happily? And others think, you know, why'd you
yeah.
have her walking like
yes.
a Virginia Woolf to her
yes.
drowning, death by
yes.
drowning?
I've had people certain that it was the
one
you know,
or the other.
They, yeah, she ended up one way or ended up another. And then they demand my concise answer for what it really is. And I usually won't answer, no, because it's alive inside them. Why would I take that away? Like, that's the whole point of why I do what I do. Yeah. That would, like, just thinking of last lines in general, the way I think about them when I write them, because I'm so careful with them. Like, I will spend longer writing an ending than I will any other part of it, because it has to work. It has to make sense, and it has to be lyrical, and it has to be musical, and it has to be like it's like the final gift to the reader. Like, they stuck with you this whole time, and the last line and the last words and the way they sound and the way they feel and like the image they create in your mind is everything. And so there's a care that goes into, or should go into, endings that I don't always see in the world. And I wish, like, everyone here, like, that's not at all a problem, but I wish there was as much care in the last lines as there was.
Well, I certainly see it in all of your work, and maybe that's another difference between the story and the novel. A novel, so much goes on before it, I don't think the last line has the weight of a last line in short fiction.
Oh, what?
Yeah, but I want it to.
Just to
catch.
Oh, yes, I should.
I'm going to keep trying.
It should.
Every line should have
only
weight.
Only Lydia's work,
every, that's the
failing,
thing.
But I want it.
That's the thing about in some novels, is that they feel so, like, baggy to me in certain ways, or like that feels like there's like moments that sag, or moments that this doesn't count as much because it's, you know, we have 800 pages to get the long way around, and I don't think it should be that way, or I feel like novels should be held to the same standards lyrically and in all ways, but I feel like sometimes novels just, they're like, now I'm going to stop, and now I'm done, and I'm going to just end it. Mm-hmm. Like, this is the full thing. It is exhausted. It's left my body. It's done. And I feel like there should absolutely be this extreme level of craft that goes with every part of it, but especially the beginnings and the endings for me.
Now, all of you are mothers, some with very young children. Karen, you have a four-month-old now? Mm-hmm. Or?
Yeah. I know. I was thinking how much more comfortable this interview is. The skillful editor cut all of me being like, and another thing, Ken, when I did my pregnant interview recently. Some amazing sound engineer made it sound less like I was just like, I don't know, on a trampoline.
Yeah. I think it was a very warm day in May, and you were 6 months pregnant.
Oh, my goodness. What a relief. It's funny just thinking about the image, actually, and this is because I am so much in baby cocoon right now, but I have a three-year-old and this four-month-old, and we're like always like reading books together, and the, you know, visuals are so, I mean, you know, the words are just sort of excuses sometimes to have like a haunted moon and a frog or whatever. Mm-hmm. And what he attends to is so rarely anything to do with the plot at this stage. It's like my friend Rivka called it the eternal landscape of the book. So it's really
Rivka
that
Galchen.
Portal into the world. He's like, whatever, maybe this frog will find its mom and maybe it won't. But I'm really curious about the dragonfly. You know, or yes. Like, and it will be sort of like something that mysteriously has snagged his heart and his attention. And I feel like it is instructive to me. I don't know, thinking about stories, I'm like, oh, there is like sort of an uncanny remainder that the object or the image can hold for us.
Right.
And he really could care less sometimes about whatever the linear, you know, plot is suggesting is the story. He's like, I think the real story might be this luminous dragonfly. Where is it going? Like, what, you know, mm-hmm. he just sort of what repeated images hold him. It's really amazing. It works like a poem. I think that's right.
Yeah. I could not agree with everything that just came out of your face more. I'm on record as saying overly righteous things like, I think plot is a hoax to keep us in line telling some kind of stories that legitimize some kind of bodies and experiences and not others. But children are among the most brilliant around us who recognize it could be the thing in the periphery or off to the side, and that could be the whole story. Were we to deviate from plot even a little.
Yeah.
I love everything you just said.
Yeah. And there's such a thing. My face is so on. I'm just speaking of young children. I don't know if I feel like this is, I'll go days without looking at other adult faces, I feel like. And like, I'm in active flight from my own reflection. I'm like, who is that Sasquatch? I'm like, oh no, it's me. So it's really nice to make eye contact in the studio with other adults.
Well, it doesn't end. Lydia, I follow you on Facebook, and you've mentioned Miles is off to college now, and he came back, and how kind of emotional it was for you. And
still
then,
is.
And then you lost a daughter in childbirth, Lily.
Maybe that's why I get so broken and have to put myself back together with normal milestones in the life of mother or a parent, it could be that that's the reason that I have a fracture there, a fracture of the heart. So when Miles was going to college, I just dissolved. And then I went to upstate New York to try and put myself back together for a while. But I have a feeling it's because I have pain and trauma there. So he's doing great. He's had 3 different hairdos, 3 different coats. Like he's stepping into, you know, the exploration of identity and self, and his shoulders are carrying it. And he looks like a young man. And I'll figure it out. Margaret's going to help me. She promised to help me. So.
And then I know Lily's had such an influence on your work.
You
remember and honor her through your art.
Yeah, it's probably the origin story or origin point for all my writing is what happened there, which means her death was generative of everything. But I'll tell you a kind of cool, less sad thing, which is I'm working on a novel right now. It's polyphonic. I'm glad you said that word. We have to start saying it a lot so people know what the hell
yes,
it is.
Yes, yeah.
And for the first time in any novel of mine, a boy has moved to the center of the story. Nice. I'm going to start crying. No, I'm not. I'm good.
I know, now we need to move the art.
And so that, I think something has, I don't really like the word healed, but something has moved a little bit. There's still a girl in it, but...
Well, there's one story that, again, affected me quite a bit, Garden of Earthly Delights in Verge. And there's a boy in there, and a very young man, and then an older man, Bosch, going in with the title.
Really subtle.
Yeah,
name.
And it was actually such a loving story. I mean, he was.
Yeah, that's my idea of tenderness, that story.
Yes, but it was.
Thank you.
Yes. He works in a fishery, mm-hmm. and lives a very desperate existence, not quite as bad as Anastasia in the Oregon Runner. And he meets this young boy, or young man, who works with him, and they develop a relationship that's extremely loving and comforting to the reader. I just felt, man, in the midst of all this, this was something joyful for him, something... again, comforting, and it was just extremely moving. It's another one that just kind of stuck in my head.
Thank you so much for caring about that story. Before my mother died, she said, "Belle," because that's her nickname for me, "Belle, how come you can't write a happy story?" and it kind of plagued me because she was right. I can't write a happy story, apparently, but I can move toward tenderness. It just looks different on the page when I do it. It looks like an Hieronymus Bosch painting when I try to make a moment that's tender. But that was me trying to pay intimacy and homage and devotion to gay male love and intimacy and sexuality, which has been among the most important influences in my life.
While staying true, as you said before, to the material conditions
right.
that Bosch
their
lives in.
Their actual yes. working conditions. Yeah.
Yes, which weren't pleasant.
Yes.
And I know, Kim and Mark, well, you mentioned your kids playing and tearing each other apart. And Kim, you've mentioned, you had the story, what was the one with the tent?
Little foxes.
Foxes, yeah, which was also very moving and a gut punch last line. And you got some of that from your watching your kids play. And you also mentioned they say some things that just kind of inspire you in your fiction.
I was just telling Karen last night that my 6-year-old said, "When I have gray hair, you'll be in the grave, right?" That's what he said to me. And it's just figuring, I'm like, yes, that's probably true. But just figuring things out. Or, you know, he was fascinated by the idea of a blood bank. He was like, "There's a whole building full of blood. This is amazing." Like, just these things that we take for granted, they are, it's psychedelic is what it is, to sort of experience life again through your kids' eyes and to just be explaining things to them. And he was saying, you know, he says in the grave because I told them I told them I wanted to be cremated or I wanted to be buried in a tree is what I said. I want to be buried under a tree, in the roots of a tree. So he's like, "Will you be in the tree then?" He asks about various things. "When I have kids, will you be in the tree?" I'm like, "I hope not. I hope I will be alive and not in the tree when you have kids." But just figuring the way they figure things out about the world. And I think it's important to talk about death. I think it's important to just answer questions honestly and as honestly as you can. But yeah, I feel like they're constantly making the world over new for me.
Yeah, they're like little philosophers. It's amazing.
And they can still
amazing.
See.
Oh, yeah, they can totally see.
And they haven't been inscribed by cultural rules and codes and laws, and so they can still see.
That's so great.
You see symmetries that you sort of forgot about. My son was like, look at those little bears in the tree. And I was like, oh, the squirrels. I don't give them their due.
Yeah.
They're really just sort of like static to me, but to you, there's just miniature bears infesting.
Yeah, I love those. My son calls gloves foot socks. Or hand socks. Wow. Hand socks or foot gloves. Like, just getting confused with socks and gloves, because it's just like, oh, right, those go on our feet, those go on our hands. Yeah. I love that stuff.
Yeah. You hear, like, the poverty of your own explanations, too, right? Like, I mean, that's a little humbling, where I was like, well, got to be careful. You know, it's like germ season here in Portland. It's just a carousel of germs wherever you go. So I'm like, well, we can't touch baby sister, who now I realize that the toddler is the greatest danger in my forget all my other, like, more amorphous fears. I'm like, it is you. But I was like, yeah, because he was like, what is a germ? I'm like, well, the sickness can jump from you into me. And I was like, oh, this is not the way. Perhaps there's a better.
Maybe, yeah.
Or like, how much of science is just an article of faith? You know, he'll ask these really pressing questions. And I'm like, you should Google that in several years.
Yeah.
Speaking of physics, right? I'm like, ooh.
Yeah.
If I can ask you to bring a message home to your son, though, I have totally gray hair, and I'll be having dinner with my dad tonight.
See,
he's
out
in
of the
assisted
gray
living, but he's not in the gray again.
No, my older son thinks that they will invent a cure for dead sometime really soon. So we'll see if that works out.
It's
I don't know. But I was explaining why I don't want there to be a cure for dead necessarily. I don't know. It's the things that we take for, you know, oh, right. It's a bear. It's a little miniature bear in a tree. That's the best. Squirrel.
So good.
Now, all of you are teachers of writing, in addition to practitioners. And Karen, you're off soon for your guest teaching semester in Austin, Texas. Margaret, you'll be teaching a short story intensive at Literary Arts in Portland this March. And Lydia, you have your own center for writing, Corporeal Writing, also near Literary Arts in downtown Portland. I wonder how you go about teaching the writing of short stories to your students, and what are the important points? I know, Lydia, you're very focused on having the students tell their own stories.
Sure. So what I'm experimenting with in this part of my life comes on the heels of leaving academia after almost 30 years, where I was pretty entrenched. And I thought I was shaking things up and agitating from the inside out. But you can't do that for so long it becomes static. And that started to feel like that was happening. So I punched through that, blew that up, which is how I make change in my life, and opened the Corporeal Center. And really, it's a non-academic, non-hierarchical space where people are encouraged to come to explore and generate art and ideas. It's not so much a place where craft gets handed to them or passed on to them, but it's more a generative writing space where we kind of make things up more organically and with an attention to creative energy, which Margaret works a lot in that kind of space too with a mutual friend of ours. And so it's not so much craft, I'm teaching those kind of words anymore. It's more collaborations around artistic practice. And it's also just incredibly important to us to have the access and the non-hierarchy be the thing that fell away at the door. And we're just experimenting still. We've only been in our space 3 years. We're babies at this. We're screwing up sometimes and getting better other times. But I wouldn't even use the word teaching anymore. I have this, remember that old book, The Artist's Way? You must remember it.
Julia Cameron.
Remember that?
Yes.
I think it's tracking back to some of those ideas when I first read that book. You know, what is artistic practice when it's not so tethered to the swear word market and so tethered to MFA programs, ideas of craft? You know, couldn't it be energy between us again? And so we're just playing with that and seeing what happens.
And I've heard you talk about writing in that way, where lots of us think of it as producing a product to sell in the capitalist marketplace. And of course, that goes on. But it's also not that.
Yeah. So I think it's alive.
Right.
And I like to get inside the aliveness. I think it's energy and matter. And I'll stop there so I don't sound like a nutter. But I think it's alive and it's a living practice.
And Karen, how would you talk about your when you're teaching, say, in Austin now?
Well, I just love everything that Lydia was saying, particularly about play, Because I think that can be really difficult in an MFA program. A lot of the students there, too, have, like, taken out loans. They've made huge sacrifices to be there. And it turns out that that doesn't always, it's not always conducive, actually, to producing your best work, because you feel this, like, hyper-burden by this sense, like, oh, my God, I dragged my family to Texas, and if I don't write, like, an award-winning story that I can exchange for cash prizes in 14 minutes, it's all for naught. You know, it's, like, this terrible pressure, I think. And, like, funding is tied to your artistic performance and stuff, and that can all feel difficult. And I think getting back into a space where people are playing, like, not in, like, a... I feel like that word doesn't get the respect that it really deserves. Because as a species, like, this is something to use, to burn up your surplus, to do something that is not, like, on the clock of a certain kind of yeah. 9-to-5 productivity. Like, what a joy, right? And to kind of wheel around in time and go groping in the dark and discovering something, like, that. I feel like the best writing I've ever done, the worst writing I've done is when, like, I'm like, all right, I've got it. I'm just, this is an allegory about medical apartheid. And, like, you know, it's like, so grim, you know? And it's like, it's always like when the story like outsmarts you, you're just yeah. kind of playing around and listening, letting the sound sort of lead you somewhere maybe. And so that, but it's hard. I think it actually is really hard to stent a space because it takes rigor too, right? And so finding that balance between play and rigor and giving these wonderful students sort of permission to play around again without feeling like, oh, I have to produce my opus in a semester, you know? I don't know. Finding like the syllabus where they get to meet their own kind of like weird aunts and uncles. That's my favorite part, I think, getting to be the DJ mix master, being like, let me introduce you to, yeah, you know, Lydia, Kim, Margaret, yeah. You know, that's the fun.
And I'm not currently teaching anywhere, but I'm available at all of your institutions if anyone would like to.
You're on our list.
Give me a call. I would love that.
I thought the word play would resonate with you,
absolutely,
too.
Absolutely, play. And I'm doing a craft talk for the National Book Foundation has this amazing program where they go into underserved communities and provide, like, workshops and classes and readings and lectures. And so I'm doing something in April at Sam Houston State that's about play and about mm-hmm. obstruction, actually, about having one of my mentors showed me how to, it sounds so simple, but it's just write a story using only one syllable words, just some crazy rule, do something crazy, start a story from a plagiarized line that you like, whatever, just do what you need to do to get into that moment of generation. And that to me is where that all that magic happens. And you can't really explain it. You have to do it. It's like drugs. It's like it's like a psychedelic. It's like you can't say this is what it's going to be like for you. You don't know until you're in the actual project how the project is going to go. But it's how do you unlock something so that people can get into that space.
And yeah. Margaret, for your like short story intensive, and this is level two, I should mention.
Yeah, so. This one's level two. And I teach out of my house now, too. And I teach the IPRC as well. But I think the biggest refrain, and like my anyone I've ever had a class with will be nodding if they hear this, but it's just like, is don't think. Don't think. Don't think. And I think that's the hardest thing to try and get students to grab onto is like, that is, and then I'm not saying that from a like, you know, not just like get out of your own head, instructoral, I made up a word there, position, but like genuinely the best work comes from a place of not thinking. It does not come from your brain. It's coming from something bigger than any of us can understand. And when we try and write completely from our brains only, we're never going to have the quality of work that most people resonate deeply with. And so when I teach, I'm always like, don't think, mm-hmm. don't think, don't think. And people think it's like, I don't know.
And it's hard to talk about without sounding like you're just like wearing your like purple turban or whatever. But yeah, like, but right, that you're walking alongside something that exceeds you and you get to be a channel for it.
Yes.
If you're lucky.
Yes.
And unfocusing in a productive way. But it's hard to sit with it. Here's a much stupider analogy, but my son really likes those magic eye paintings. You guys remember where you're like, if you like, and it's hard, there's no way to explain to someone how it happens.
No.
And he'll be like, it's happening.
It's happening,
but
yeah.
you can stop it from happening with your own like dreadful excitement. I don't know. It's somehow such a strange space to occupy where you're like, I will be patient and trust that something is going to come into focus slyly, but I really can't will it. I can't. No. I don't know. And it's hard to...
There's like childbirth metaphors in there too. Like you let the contraction happen. You don't have to do anything. The body knows what to do. Letting things come is very hard. It's very challenging for people to not think, especially in academia. They're like, this is what we've been... We're so bright. We're gifted. We're here. Right. And you're like, no, but you have to leave all that stuff at the door to get anywhere
deeper. Or you have what might even be like a really brilliant idea for a story, and it sounds great, and you're like, you're like, I'm gonna be laughing all the way to the bank, and that's just the wrong headset. Wrong headset to be in.
It's like the whole, you know, like the stargazing thing of like, you have to not quite look at it in order to see it clearly, right? It's which is like, well, how do you teach that? Like, you don't. You just try it and fail and try it and fail and try it and fail and get it. And then try it.
And you know it when you know it when you get it.
Yeah, of course.
And you can't explain it, and you can't describe it to anyone else either.
Like when you get your first line and your last line, you kind of know you've arrived.
And who knows if that's even true? It's just set. It's some bizarre logic that I've set up with myself, and it's an agreement that I've had with myself to decide that it's right. You know, because that's all stories are. It's like weird little bizarre logic problems that you're working out from the beginning to the end, according to some rules that you're making on the fly in the moment that aren't, you know, whatever, that are based on gut or who knows what.
Yeah, which I think is why teaching, it's a funny, it's a little bit fraught for me too, because it feels almost you're like more like a companion or an apothecary who's like, maybe these, like, here's some medicines I can prescribe you from, like,
but
other artists, and maybe
helpful.
It will help you. And I remember the sorrow I felt as a student. I mean, we had, Kim and I had some professors come, and I remember going to Sam, and he was like, in like a Smokey the Bear voice, he was like, Karen, only you can revise this story. Yeah. And I was like, no, I need you to tell me. Just tell me what to do.
Isn't there someone else? Or like, isn't there?
Yeah,
but Lydia, your workshop was that was perfect for me, because I felt like so if certain camps are prescriptive for sure, and I like to lean into that sometimes and say, I'm going to follow all your rules, Mr. Lish. I'm going to do what you want to do because I want to see what I can get out of it. But what I loved about Lydia's workshop is this idea of It's in the space of the room, and it's in the space of your head, but there's nothing I can tell you. You're going to come to it on your own. I'm going to give you a list of things, and I'm going to guide you and help you and be supportive of you while you get there. That's sometimes the best thing that you can say to students.
Mm-hmm. Or I'm going to read you really well. Like, I'll help you to echolocate in this strange darkness that you generated.
I'm going to give you attention. I'm going to give your story attention no matter what stage it's at. That's the best thing that you can do for them in that moment.
Now again, I'm so grateful for you guys coming in. I had a few more questions, but I think we're pretty much close to the hour. Before we close, though, I wanted to talk about some upcoming events. And Lydia, the book I mentioned is coming out February 4th. She's kind of holding. She's not looking forward to a big book tour, but you'll be launching that at Powell's on Tuesday, February 4th, when the book comes out at 7:30.
Yes, thank you for the mention.
And I would advise everybody to get there early. The place will be packed, and it's Powell's downtown. And Margaret, as mentioned, you'll be teaching the short story intensive. That's through Literary Arts, and that starts on March 12th and goes every Thursday evening from 6 to 9. Since it is level 2, students will either have taken level 1 or got your permission.
Yes, correct. Okay. Yeah.
And Karen, we mentioned that you're heading off to Austin in a few days.
It's true.
To teach for a semester.
Then I will return. We can all reunite on a boat in the Willamette. Let's do it.
I hope you'll be visiting the Buddy Holly statue in Lubbock.
I have.
Trying to scale it.
Scaling it
in a drunken stupor.
I have no conception of Texas. It's just big, but I don't know how far away each town
is. That's a drive.
That's like quite a drive. Yeah. Okay. I did it all the time.
Oh, my. Well, Margaret Malone, Karen Russell, Kimberly King Parsons, and Lydia Yuknovich, thanks so much for joining us in the neighborhood this morning. It's been a pleasure, and I'm still kind of floating.
Thanks so much for having us.
Well, that's all for this episode of Mr. Jones's Neighborhood here on KABU Community Radio, or KABU Neighborhood Radio, as I like to call it. If you missed any part of the show, would just like to hear it all again, you can stream this episode and previous episodes online at kboo.fm/program/Mr. Jones's Neighborhood, or just search for it on the KABU website. Before we head out the door, a big neighborhood thank you to Margaret Malone, Karen Russell, Kimberly King Parsons, and Lydia Yuknovich for joining us live in the KABU studios. Lydia will be reading and signing books at Powell's City of Books in downtown Portland on Tuesday, February 4th at 7:30 p.m., and I advise you to get there early. And Margaret will be teaching a short story intensive class at Literary Arts, also in downtown Portland, starting on March 12th. You can find more information at margaretmalone.com. Can't leave without giving a big thank you to our engineer in the air room, the inimitable, unparalleled, and lover of short fiction, especially if it's animated, Sonia Buttrell. And of course, thanks to all of you for listening. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying, hope it's always a beautiful day in your neighborhood.